So welcome to this week's edition of the Retail Risk Podcast, sponsored by Sensormatic and supported by Orange. My guest this week is Ed Whitehead, MD Europe for Signify. Now, Ed leads a team here in Europe looking after Signify's EMEA client base and driving its expansion. Prior to that, he's worked for a number of well-known companies in this space, including Experian and Hitwise. Ed, welcome this morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Slightly unusual one. We often have, you know, no disrespect to you from the vendor side, but we often have retailers or academics coming in. But I purposely invited you to join us because you've spoken at a few of our conferences in the past. And I have to say, without bigging you up too much, I'm always really impressed by your balanced view of what's going on in the world of retail and particularly e-com, and hence the reason that that we've got you here today. So thank you for that. But before we get going, I always love this question. You've got an impressive CV. It looks the part on LinkedIn. But what was your actual intended career? Did young Ed sit there staring out of the classroom window thinking, do you know what? Experian and Signify are in my future. I'm sure neither of them existed at the time in the nicest sense. But how did you get to this point, and what was the journey?
What did I want to be when I grow up? That's the question. First off, thank you for the fabulous intro. You've put it a bit on a pedestal there, so I've got to compete with academics and retail veterans. Well, I'll do what I can to fulfil that brief. So I don't think anyone in this country really looks at their career when they're young and looks at sales. And really that's what I started in was sales ultimately. It's not so much of a profession here as it is perhaps in other countries. So I actually did engineering at university. So I studied engineering at Nottingham and started my career on the spanners. I was working for a company that made tablet manufacturing equipment. So all your ibuprofens, all the other sort of tablets you and I just can knock down whenever we need. I worked on the machines that was manufacturing those and selling them into LATAM and Spain. So a fantastically interesting job, a lot of travel. But I sort of noticed that the guys who were programming the software of the machines, not making the machines, well, they were making a bit more money, and they were also, you know, not having to carry around a big toolbox with them as well. It's just a laptop, and that's all they were. And early 20s, you're driven a little bit by money at that stage. So sort of got into the software bit, and the software bit sort of went, okay, well, what's behind the software? And all of the data, and there's people getting more and more insights out of the data. And it coincided with wanting to move to London. Again, standard path for so many young people after university. So I ended up at Experian, and yeah, definitely no one goes, well, I want to grow up learning about data and credit risk at Experian. But once you start it, it's really quite interesting, actually. And that natural progression, I went from, I think I did 3-4 years at Experian, had the opportunity to work for a fast moving identity company at the time, a company called Gigya. I was number 2 on the ground there. We took that through to acquisition with SAP, and that's when I met Raj Ramanand, my current CEO, and we really got together, and over a coffee, he said, look, do you want to come and do that for Signify? It's such a standard route for Valley companies, isn't it? You know, you build your rep and your presence in the homeland, in the Valley, and then you look at launching in Europe, whether that's out of Berlin, whether that's out of London. They tend to be two of the sort of main parts. So that's what brought me to Signify sort of 3 years ago. That was the migration. I miss being on the spanners. You know, I still love taking things apart. You know, I've got a garage full of bikes. I love stripping those down. I like to think I could still do that to a car, but you open the bonnet of a car now, just don't go near it. But yeah, you know, certainly we've moved into such a data and software orientated world. It's the place to be.
It's funny when you mentioned there at the start that on the tablet side, because obviously on the technology point of view, my initial thought was, oh, I had no idea you had a background with Samsung or Apple. such as the mindset. And so
that's what a tablet is now. Yeah, yeah. Not 250,000 Nurofen pouring out of a machine you know, every hour, but yeah, tablets that you type and surf the net on.
Yeah, the original.
So look, gets twisted.
First of all, talk to me about your day-to-day now, and I do actually want you to give our listeners a little overview of what Signify does in a sort of compressed version, because I think that will provide some really important context to where we go next with the chat.
Yeah, absolutely. So Signify, really, we provide, now I'm going to try something new here, we provide transaction and action screening. Now let me sort of explain what I mean by that. So we've come from the point of where we sit in the merchant's checkout and we screen transactions. That's the fundamental basis of what we do. The goal is that we are looking to accept as many transactions as possible, you know, really minimize those false positives, maximize approval rates, and therefore maximize the amount of revenue that a merchant can take. And we are so confident in our decisions that we will also give a chargeback guarantee to that merchant where it's applicable. Obviously, in Europe with SCA, that's getting less applicable, but at US, LATAM, Asia Pac, certain markets, that chargeback guarantee is still really attractive. So that's the transaction screening. Then I'm going to explain that action screening bit. And so we're sort of looking at other places in the purchase journey where we can help merchants. And that action could be creating an account, adding a card, customer login, customer return, customer claiming an item hasn't been received, a customer refund, all of those actions as well. We can use our same network of data. We can use our same machine learning principles to really look at that and say, you know, do we think that action should be happening at that time? What's the next best cause, action again for the merchant to take there? Should they increase friction at that point? Should they challenge the user? Should they, in fact, block that action as well? So we're trying really now to help our merchants protect them end to end in that purchase journey, right from the moment of account creation through to what should they do with a refund. And of course, that does, you know, almost to reiterate, take in the account logins. Should someone be logging in with a Chinese browser on Russian time zone or, you know, whatever, to a UK site? Adding a card, equally adding a card, then purchasing something all within, I don't know, 5 seconds looks a bit dubious. You probably want to add a bit of friction and slow that one down. We've seen huge amounts of increase in the item not received abuse element as fraud itself in Europe gets sort of shut down a little bit by SCA. So yeah, just how do we end-to-end help merchants? Because there's so much more to do out there than just that sort of plain transaction screening and checkout. We use a shared network. All our clients come together. It helps give us that knowledge. And then machine learning, as I say, you know, that shared network means that if, I know, client A in the Far East is getting attacked, we can apply that to client B in LATAM and just really get ahead of the fraud attacks before they get out of control.
Yeah, and it's long been said, you know, the bad guys and girls are sharing data at lightning speed.
You know what, they're doing it.
For years, retailers were like, oh no, we can't possibly do that. So,
oh my God, it's such the butterfly effect, or, you know, the mirror image. For every company, an employee that's working 9 to 5 to stop this action, there are the equivalent working 9 to 5, working harder than us to get around the system, right? To unpick it. That's the game of it. That's what I found quite interesting as well. There's a bit of beauty to that. So yeah. But day to day, it was number one on the ground, as I say, launching the operation. So I'm lucky. I get to do loads of little things. You know, we're kind of a small organization in a big organization. I still get to talk to clients, which I love, you know, still get to try and help them with their solutions. That's both pre-sales and then obviously sort of sponsor a lot of our enterprise clients. I dabble in marketing until marketing tell me to get out of there because I don't know what I'm doing. Support. I mean, we had a client over the bank holiday who thought they were getting a fraud attack, and they've still got my number. So they call me. I'm walking through a field with the family and the phone goes off and I'm like, oh, they think they've got a fraud attack. And so I'm CS for the day. I quite like that. You know, I like that ability to see all aspects of the business. It keeps it fresh. It keeps it exciting.
Yeah, although you got to love it when the client rings you in daylight hours. You know, I've been there where it's 3 o'clock in the morning and they've still got your number. And sure. That's a company you don't work for anymore. But anyway,
absolutely. Yeah, it's the last company, but your relationship with them is so good that they're still like, and then you explain, they're like, well, can you find someone for me? Like, I worked there for 5 years.
Yeah. I'm in a field. Look, you know, we one of the things, you know, there's lots of people looking back at the moment about, you know, what's gone on in, you know, the last 12, 18 months. And I think that conversation's largely kind of been, you know, done. But I'm interested in your thoughts, you know, looking forward from where we are, there has been some changes over, you know what, but what are the current trends? What changes are going to stick around? Which ones do you think are going to fall away? And are we going to go back to some form of normal? And what, you know, what do you see coming online? And is it arriving, like the press tell us, 5-7 years earlier than it was going to?
You know, I kind of like it when people get proved wrong a little bit. You know, just there was such a wealth of people going, you know, oh, 6 years compound annual growth acceleration, all these things, and hey, we did it a little bit. You know, I'm proud that we did it. Oh, this is what's happening at the moment. And you look at the ONS stats and retail's dropping off a little bit online. You know, great, we're getting that balance back. You look at groceries, I think they're one of the ones that's retracting the fastest, but they've jumped so far ahead. You know, so you've got to put it all in context. Is there going to be a rebalancing? Yes, we're already seeing it. Is that healthy? Yes, absolutely. Do I like going down the high street? Well, not massively myself, but I work off Oxford Street in London, so the main shopping street there. And it is busy. You know, there are people going into shops. You want to touch, you want to feel, you want to see some of these items. I think that's great. If we ended up in a world without that, it's so sterile just buying something online. The facility of it, the ease of it, I get it totally. But you need to have this balance in retail, I think. And High Street keeps not just the Costas and the Pret's alive, but the little cafes, you know, and the hub. And you know, we've kept an office open throughout, really, other than the, you know, obvious closed lockdowns. And it's great to have people interact. I mean, we're doing this by Zoom, but how much nicer would it be if we be sitting in a room with a cup of tea having this conversation? So I think human nature will tend to draw us back together as individuals. I think the people, you know, what has changed online is there's a lot more people selling online, right? It's a real opportunity, and it's an opportunity for people to excel for sure. And those who do this well will persist. And in terms of how the trends are changing, I think the biggest thing we've seen is, unfortunately, I mean, fortunately for Signified in a way, but unfortunately for retail online in general, you know, the more volume you have, the more opportunity the bad people see in it as well. You know, so the more opportunity fraudsters see to hide in that increased volume, hide in the perhaps the increased pressure that you're, you know, if you work with a lot of manual review and you're suddenly got 3-4 times the amount of orders, unless you've got a very understanding boss giving you 3-4 times the amount of people overnight, you've got to deal with masses more volume. So that pressure to make the decisions quickly, that pressure on the systems, and I think that has created a trend where there is more fraud getting through at the moment. And I think it's getting reined in quite quickly, which is good. And the shape of fraud has changed as well, or the shape of bad behavior. So there are many good transaction screening tools out there, right? Blocking fraud in the checkout is a complex task, but not an impossible task. And the fraudsters know that. And SCA makes it even harder in Europe. So we've seen people move more towards that post-purchase piece I've mentioned earlier, just claiming they never received it. And as a retailer, you don't want to upset the customer, so you probably just give them another item or you just give them a refund. First time, okay. Second time, suspect. If they're doing that across the network and we can see that and we can tell you, the retailer, you know not to honor that. But so, yeah, we're definitely seeing the shape of fraud. We call it consumer abuse, more change as opportunists sort of look at other parts of the funnel to try and get away with it, really.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned consumer abuse there, because I must admit I did look at your website a couple of days ago and something caught my eye. So I am going to pick up on that. But before I do, we're just going to take a quick break and have a word from our sponsors, and then we'll be back.
Now, more than ever, retailers and shopping centres need to create efficient and safe shopping destinations that can thrive in the most challenging of market conditions. Sensormatic Solutions uniquely combines insights into loss and liability, shopper insights and inventory visibility to help you power operational excellence and deliver frictionless, secure, personalised shopper experiences while driving revenue. Visit us at sensormatic.com to learn more.
So welcome back to this week's edition of the Retail Risk Podcast. I am talking with Ed Whitehead, MD Europe of Signified. Now, you touched just before the break there on the consumer abuse side, and obviously consumers possibly claiming that items weren't received. Now, I looked on your website and you actually have an index and you track this in some way. Talk to me about that a little bit more, because I found the whole concept, you know, fascinating. It's almost one of those, you know, a few years ago or in physical stores, it was internal theft, which was sort of not really spoken about. And is it possible that our staff might actually be defrauding us? Now we're around to the conversation of going, do you know what? We might be a high-end retailer, but some of our customers aren't really the sort of people that we want. So what's going on there?
Yeah, so this is our effort a little bit to try and use the data that we've got to help merchants understand the industry a little bit and also benchmark themselves against other people. You know, the worst thing is feeling like you're left on your own and you don't know whether am I doing well, am I doing bad, is this normal, whatever it is. So if you think about it, we have hundreds of billions of transactions, so like thousands and thousands of merchants literally going through our going through the network. And all of that gives us various data points. We also receive chargebacks from people. I mentioned we have this chargeback guarantee, but whether we give a guarantee or whether we just receive the information to improve the model, we have that sort of closed feedback loop. So it lets us put out some data that we give to our merchants, is available on the website. It's called our pulse data, and we can do sort of bespoke reporting for clients who ask for it. Basically, it looks in there and it's saying, well, what are these different types of fraud? How many of those could have been won in a challenge? How many have we won by representing the merchant on the, on that process? The consumer abuse, well, we've got two really, the fraud index, and that is just how many fraudulent attacks do we see against our merchant base? And we've seen that go up and up. You know, there are more and more people trying to get away with it. And then the consumer abuse piece, that's really doing the same, but for these item not received, promo abuse, item not as described claims as well. So we'll see the volume of those. We'll see how many we think are legitimate or not, how many we've challenged, how many we've won. And that's the fundamental data that puts into our consumer abuse index. You know, how do we see that element growing? So it gives you the fraud element on one side and this consumer abuse on the other to sort of compare where your fraud pressures are. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I guess it's one of those things that, and your point about there, you know, feeling that you're not on your own and allowing people to benchmark themselves, because you're right. And it, again, I come back to the internal theft. And before that, it was, you know, your shrinkage or, you know, loss figure within the store. It's only when people, so if you like, you know, get over themselves and realize sharing this information is valuable. You're not giving away anything super sensitive or commercially,
you're not sharing sales data. You're not sharing performance metrics. Even not sharing users, right? The concept of the user is not there. It's a construct of multiple data points. That's what you're looking for in any sort of machine learning and knowledge-based pairing, is whether it's my email address, my device ID, whatever it is, how many instances of that device, of that email, all sort of spider web together, can we see in the reference data? So when we then say, oh, you know, do we think that's a good transaction or not? We're not looking at Ed Whitehead profile. Oh, he looks like a decent guy who lives in London and looks like his house is, you know, all right. He'll be all right for it. We're not. We're looking at all the different instances that say, yeah, that's not faked. You can't have that many intertwined data points faked. Therefore, go ahead with it. It's a good transaction. But you're not sharing, as a company who works with us, you're not sharing your secret sauce or anything. It is a thing. People have to get over that reluctance or that concern, and then you benefit from it.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, you got to hope that you don't show up on some database somewhere as Ed Whitehead with 250,000 tablets in the garage at your house, because there'll be a whole,
exactly.
There'll be a van full of people wearing balaclavas thinking they're going to get something they're not when they arrive.
Well, I mean, let's not go down this route, but I was selling that equipment to countries in LATAM, and some of the countries in LATAM, I think they wanted the machines for purposes different to the defense. I'm not going to lie. I did have moments where there were bags of cash on the table, and I'm like, I can't do that.
Yeah. So, certainly not for only one bag.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's the negotiation. I said it like sales.
That's right. It's like there's an engineering firm not far from where I live. And for those old enough, remember when the Iranians managed to buy what was called a super gun, this huge. Anyway, that was manufactured by an engineering firm up 4 or 5 miles down the road from me. And they're like, well, we just thought it was a really big pipe, and they paid well for it and on time.
Crazy. East Midlands, we divert to a local audience now, unfortunately, but East Midlands is an engineering hotbed. That's where, you know, a lot of British engineering still happens. Anyway, that's a whole nother podcast.
So look, there you are, providing data to an insight to your clients and future clients. How on earth do you stay up to date with what's going on? I mean, you know, do you use that inquisitive mind of yours to go on the dark web of a weekend and see what's going on? I mean, what is the process? I'm always fascinated how you sort of try and keep up.
Yeah. So obviously I'm not going to give you our secret sauce. We look at the dark web a little bit. I know some companies make a big thing of how they track the dark web. I mean, it tends to move so quickly from the dark web to real life that, you know, you see it anyway, right? So the techniques that are put on the dark web come out immediately, and we're able to sort of spot them. Also, I don't know if you've seen, like, Craigslist and I've forgotten the name of the other one, but there's so many returns, refunds, abuse guides now, templates and guides. They're not on the dark web. They are literally being posted in plain sight. So we don't focus hugely on that because we find them anywhere. How do you stay ahead of the game? We mentioned earlier, there are as many people trying to scam the system as there are people trying to protect the system. So it's always cat and mouse. And any company that says they don't get caught out occasionally is lying to you, right? There's absolutely no way. There's been some really sophisticated fraud attacks lately from different countries around the world. The benefit we have, again, is, well, going back to that network piece. So we genuinely do have customers everywhere. So if we see something spike, as I say, in the Far East, we can immediately apply it to, you know, to our LATAM base or to the global base, as simple as that. But if someone's trying to steal trainers in one part of the world, they're probably going to try and steal the trainers everywhere else as well. So you can make some assumptions. The other thing we do, which I think is, you know, fantastic brains. We have some amazing data science people. Yes, we decision as much as we can with machine learning, but we've got a team as well who are just risk analysts, risk experts, and they're always looking, does that look wrong? You know, you've got so many triggers around volume, around density of IP usage, around browser with language over the top, you know, so when any of these alarms or triggers go off, the team are there permanently 24/7 looking for, oh, hang on, we think this has changed. So you can immediately put a rule in place to block that. And then whilst you unpick and figure out, well, what's that really looking like? Is that legitimate? Is it, you know, a new fraud spike? and then feed that into the machine, you get that chargeback loop. So it immediately starts to learn. But it's a constant cat and mouse game. There are some very clever people on the other side of the fence just reverse engineering it. And that's why rules do not work, because sweeping statement, but generally rules are, you know, you can back engine, you can reverse engineer them. Yeah. So like you got to have someone, even as simple as just going down volume, value by value by value. Oh yeah, that works. Oh, that works with that. And so you've got to look at machine learning. You've got to look at defenses that are complex enough to stop people just picking their way through them. But yeah, it's an interesting part of the game.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the whole rules-based thing, where there was very rigid rules, they would work for, you know, a day or a week. And then they'd be out of date because all the bad guys and girls have figured out the rules exactly. And then they've shared them.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, the sharing network, we spoke about it. We're not the only people doing it. It happens both sides of the fence, of course.
So look, final question. You've given a thumbs up for the high street, and it's making a comeback. Maybe it'll evolve. But how do you see retail in the next sort of, I don't know, pick 3, 4, 5 years? The blend, what's your a personal take? Where do you sit on this?
Yeah. So part of my personal take is within the last 3 months, I bought a car online. I bought a car online, sight unseen, clicked the button, paid my money, then had massive buyer remorse. Oh my God, I was only browsing it. I didn't mean to click buy. And then it turns up at home, the old car goes, and I think, you know what? That's worked all right. I'll probably do that again. Grocery, I've not been in a supermarket for 2 years. You have the odd bag of beans you need to give back, but I tell you what, the rest of that works pretty well for me. So I think there's going to be there is the shift in mindsets. Will I still occasionally go to a car showroom to look at cars I can't afford? Yeah, I probably will, because, you know, there's, again, it's that experience piece. So I think, almost as I mentioned earlier, facility shopping, yes, online, the winners there will be the people who put the right systems in place. And, you know, I want to say our customers, right? Because it doesn't matter what traffic they face, they can handle it. You know, it doesn't matter what fraud pressures they face, they can handle it, sort of thing. So people who put the right systems in place online and excel at customer experience, they're going to persist. You know, there will be some companies who fall behind because there's so many people selling the same stuff online. Behaviors, even to expensive goods, yes, you'll be able to buy them online. But I do still think the high streets will be a place for people to get together and experience as well. And you look at Samsung, one of our clients, they have experience stores, which aren't really even designed to sell anything. In fact, you can't buy in the store. You can take a QR code, you can take a barcode away, fine, and go and buy it afterwards. But you are there to play with the TV, to look at the item, to play with a coffee machine and go, yeah, I like that, I don't like that, whatever it is. Miele do the same thing. And then you go away and then you make your purchase in a separate channel. So it probably brings that omni-channel piece. But people who say high street's dead, high street's evolving, it's not dead. And I really hope it doesn't die, because I think it's a fundamental part of our society, really.
Yeah, I mean, you make the point there about the experience. So I was in a shopping centre a few months ago, and there was a car brand, and they had it was in a shopping mall, but you couldn't buy a car, but they had a wall with all of their sports models, and you could press the button and listen to the exhaust note from each of the different models. So those people that were driven by, you know, the sound aspect, they could experience that. So yeah, I think, and it was great. And they got a little simulator. So my boys are 8 and 9, and they're playing, it was a Mercedes show, and they're pretending to be Lewis Hamilton while, you know, I'm pressing all buttons on the shanty model. So yeah, it was a great experience.
Daddy, can I have this car?
Somebody will call you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to exchange your details. You've had a great experience. You haven't even tarnished your experience with the transfer of funds at that point, as well. So the psychology of it as well is you go home just excited about the brand. The whole having to part with your cash comes as a separate transaction. It's quite clever stuff.
Yeah, it is. Look, Ed, it's been fantastic. Thank you very much for navigating us through your thoughts and that insight. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I will just shout out for those in the UK. I happen to know that I think you might even be speaking at the Retail Risk event at the King Power Stadium in Leicester, 2nd of December, and then possibly partying the night away at the Fraud Awards afterwards. So for those of our UK viewers and listeners, Ed will be there at that. But for now, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to getting together in person as that all starts to get back to normal in the near future.
Indeed. Always a pleasure, Paul, and I look forward to seeing you at the event.
Thanks, Ed.
Cheers now. Have a good day.